that tickets start at 99p. So for the whole experience, Breathe, Watch, Discuss with a meal, you can go for 99p. And we call it the kind of 99p community ticket, which is for those in our community who are normally left out of these kind of events and these conversations. And at our events, we have a range of demographics, like colours, ages, genders. That was quite nice and just natural, and it just happened. But it is the person that has the money to go to this that is going to come to it. So by kind of having that ticket, it removes the financial barrier for those that wouldn't normally go and allows them to be part of the experience, part of the conversation, and to just join in.
Today I'm joined by Alex Fish, a trailblazer in social cinema and a staunch advocate for environmental and social justice. Alex's journey from the bustling streets of London to the tranquil shores of Cornwall mirrors his quest for meaningful impact and community-driven change. In the episode, we explore who Alex is as a human and what or who made him. We delve into Alex's eclectic background as a social butterfly in London, connecting with diverse cultures, to his transformative experience in Malaysia, grappling with the real-world challenges of conservation, and the pivotal moment that led him to question the traditional paths of environmentalism. It's at 29 minutes in, but we focus on Alex's journey to founding 99p Films, the social cinema venture that's more than just a business, it's a movement. Through his innovative model of Breathe, Watch, Discuss, and Eat, or Feast, 99p Films aims to democratise cinema, making it a tool for building social and environmental awareness and community. Alex discusses the power of communal viewing, the importance of accessibility in the arts, and how 99p Films bridges the gap between entertainment and activism. Alex's story is really a testament to the power of passion, adaptability, and his relentless pursuit of a better world. He's a beacon of inspiration for anyone that's looking to make a difference through creativity, community, and a deep connection with our planet. Now, over to Alex. Alex, welcome to the Impossible Network.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
It's great to be chatting to you. And where do I find you today?
I am in Cornwall in the UK, in a little place called Penryn, just on the outskirts of Falmouth.
Delightful.
In a building called Launchpads, which you can't see, but it's where I'm based and where I do all my work. Yeah.
We've established with the introduction about what you're doing, and we'll get on to talk about that in more detail. But let's start with a big question. Alex, who are you as a human being?
Who am I as a person? That's a very big question. But I think like the two things that come to my mind, one is I definitely feel like I'm a bit of a social butterfly in the sense of even from like an early age, I grew up in London, always used to go to the park and just play with anyone and just find friends. And being London, you had everyone from different nationalities and countries and languages and ages. I love talking to people and just communicating and networking, connecting and collaborating, which is probably like a big part of 99p Films and what I've maybe focused my energy in terms of that element. I kind of have this thing where I like to be a bit of a mirror to the person that I'm with. So I kind of have all these different alter egos or facades that if I'm in a certain community or group or whatever, I can kind of shape shift, which I enjoy. I guess there could be like a negative view on that is, you don't know who you are, but it's kind of like fun to just play with like different elements of me. And yeah, so I kind of mirror the situation that I'm in, who am I talking to, kind of test the waters with perspective.
It's, I suppose, to call it classic NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, is okay. The term for it. So it's a mechanism for engaging and getting on with people, whatever the social situation.
Yeah. I would agree with that. But just generally speaking, probably what we'll go into as to, you know, why I'm doing 99p Films, to not sound too cliche, but I am just a complete advocate for human rights, the social side of things, looking at like social politics, social classes, how does the systemic world that we live in affect people, behavior, psychology, and then equally the environment and how do we connect with our environment? How do we, as this incredible species that we are, look to nurturing it and kind of bringing it back to life? Because the last couple hundred years, we've decimated it and destroyed a lot of it. So yeah, we focused on just what I can do in my own element. And we've all got our own perks and positives that we can kind of hold on to. And someone might use their creativity, someone might use their business, someone use whatever. But for me, is it kind of improving both social and environmental justice?
That's pretty clear. So that does lead, the first thing comes to mind, that you say you're a mirror for every conversation, then who is real Alex? Who's Alex today that's turned up to this podcast? That could take us down a really interesting rabbit hole. So we'll maybe sort of skip that one.
Well, it's Tuesday and it's 2:45. Ah, oh,
yeah. I suppose that does lead us to the next question as to who made you the human being that you are, the person that you are, or what circumstances led you? I mean, you mentioned growing up in London that maybe helped you develop that social worldview and helped you develop that connective tissue to other human beings. But I'd love you to reflect on that.
Yeah. I grew up with my mum, who's from Serbia, so I'm half Serbian. And she was a single mum, love her to bits, and a big part of who I am is the kind of support, encouragement, confidence, and love that she gave me. And we kind of chatted a little bit before, but I really enjoy having this kind of dual nationality and the fact that I can speak to her in Serbia and I can speak to my family in Serbia and just having a bit of alternative culture when it comes to food and music and language, which I feel really blessed to have. I didn't have to learn it. I'm terrible at French, terrible at Spanish, tried to learn both. And because I was a baby and she taught it from a young age, then that was just an easy way to learn a language. But have that within me, that is quite nice that I can look at things from an alternative perspective. And maybe that's even like being a bit of a who am I crisis, because at home I'm speaking Serbian, I go out and I'm speaking English, and there's, you know, which one do I align with? And maybe that's where, what did you call it? NLG?
NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming.
Maybe a little bit of that comes from that element. But yeah, so she was a massive, well, she still is a massive role in who I am and my development.
But that must have been interesting growing up. I mean, I grew up moving house between Scotland, England, other places, and wherever you go, you always feel like an outsider wherever you are. So there must have been an element with you being half Serbian when you're at school, even in a cosmopolitan city like London. There must have been an element of that where you always felt like, for example, if England playing Serbia at football. I mean, come on, which
that's
side?
That's the first game of the Euros.
It's the Euros, yeah.
I think they're definitely. I know what you're saying with that. You feel neither part of one nor the other. But then again, growing up in a school in London, you're actually more of an outsider if you're English than if you're not English, kind of thing. So I wouldn't have said that I felt like an imposter or anything like that. Obviously, when I go to Serbia, my kind of fluency is that of an 8-year-old kid with a lot of grammatical errors. So I stand out like a sore thumb. And when I tell people that I'm from London, they're like, really? You don't sound like you're from London. So yeah, neither or both, whatever it is. I haven't got like a complex over it. Like, it's more that I kind of enjoy having that like dual side of it all.
Hmm. And when you talked, when I asked you about who you are, you discussed your worldview and having an environmental conscience and a social conscience. How did that evolve? What impacted you?
the catalyst was probably David Attenborough, as it was for a lot of people. And yeah, just got really, I just loved watching Planet Earth, Blue Planet, wanted to go down that kind of like conservation biology route. I enjoyed biology and geography in like high school. They were my like favorite subjects, but especially the human side of geography and kind of like, yeah, international relations. And I think my mum's quite political, has very strong political views. So then maybe that seeps in terms of like how I view politics. And yeah, just kind of went down the wanting to be a conservationist. And I don't know if I...
The power of
David... there because
No, the it's amazing. The power of David Attenborough and the power of documentary. And you think about... I mean, he is a sort of a British institution. And
he
I
is.
Suppose even globally.
And I think especially for like a lot of people maybe in like my age bracket where we were growing up with having these incredible, yeah, documentaries and books that was kind of the first time that you'd ever seen any of this stuff. And it was these kind of alien worlds that were on our own planet. And I just, yeah, I was fascinated and hooked. And
so how did that impact you when being at school and thinking about your career and the direction you were going to take your life? I mean, if you felt that conservation, geography and biology, I mean, it's the natural career path would have to end up going to university, studying geography and becoming a geologist or an explorer or whatever. But you've ended up in a social cinema. So what were those early ambitions?
It wasn't direct. It was a lot of meandering and exploring other options. I first did an undergrad in marine biology.
Went the natural path.
I did go the natural path initially. And I definitely would say was probably like persuaded out of the more like creative, artistic routes just because of the job security and what they kind of instill on you in secondary school and at college is that this is going to get you that job. What's the ranking of the union? I was very kind of fixated on that and probably because of it chose the wrong uni. I went to Southampton, which is great for what they do, but it's very like chemistry, physics, oceanography orientated. So that was a difficult few years.
So you were interested in art and the creative side of life when you were at school?
Not so much actual art, creating stuff and whatever else, but was always like having ideas and had a very in-depth imagination and wanting to create certain things, whatever else. And even actually thinking about it, even when I was like quite a young kid, like 6, 7, I remember having like a VHS camcorder, going to the local park or like making little silly videos and stop motion things. So maybe that was there from a young age, but it kind of got a little bit suppressed just in terms of the whole, you know, how is this going to be a career? People don't make money from art, blah, blah, blah. So took down that more like safer academic route, which I finished and ended up then a day after handing in my dissertation, got on a flight, went to Malaysia and was a field biologist.
Wow.
So like, yeah.
Literally, you're straight out of uni into the field.
Into the fields. And there was this whole thing, like the whole time I was at uni, there was all of these kind of, you have to pay to go to Cuba and like hunt lionfish because they're an invasive species, or you have to pay and go to the Bahamas and kind of look after a certain turtle. Or there was definitely quite a lot of privilege, I think, that came with people that were doing that course, and you kind of like had to spend money to gain experience in the field, which I didn't have, but also I didn't agree with. I was like, if we're going to be not slaves, but we're contributing, we're kind of volunteers to some extent, then the last thing should be that we also pay for it.
But were these programs that were university promoted. So the university were getting some sort of fiscal or financial benefit from it.
I'm not sure if they were getting some benefit, but I know that they were kind of being like promoted through the uni.
Yeah, so they curated.
They were done by a different party, but then the university would be like, oh, there's this and this and that that you can get involved in. I remember one of them was like Operation Wallacey, or you've got like loads of different groups. And I don't want to now shun them and put a negative point of view, because they do good work. And I guess those that can pay for it and want the experience, great. But I wasn't in that category. Mm-hmm. So when I found this one that meant that like I wasn't getting paid, but I was getting the experience essentially for free, I was having my board and food covered, then I saw that as like an equal, like a fair value exchange.
Mm-hmm. So you found yourself on the sunny shores of Malaysia.
Yeah, which was paradise, and it was an island called Langtinga on the east coast. I'm like living that dream. I'm like snorkeling and identifying species, and we were doing lots of like turtle kind of conservation, or essentially beach patrols. But the more I was there, the more I started like questioning my impact on two levels, kind of the scientific impact and what were we actually justifying here, or what were we discovering that was new, or is there any actual groundbreaking research, or is it kind of just to produce another research paper that isn't going to go anywhere? But also my physical impact, the fact that I'd flown however many thousand of miles to get there, then every week you've got a boat going between the island and the mainland, bringing loads of food, then like our impact on tourism. I just kind of start to see it as both just let nature do its thing. Like, I don't want to now move some eggs 20 meters to the left because they're going to be under a tree and therefore at a different temperature. And I don't know, there was an element of, I just want to let nature do its thing. And I feel like I'm imposing on them. But also, why isn't a Malaysian doing that? Like, why am I coming over and taking something that a local that knows the island, or that knows the language, understands the culture, because they would eat turtle eggs there. And it's, who am I to now say that they can't? So there was that, and just it really made me reassess my views on conservation, on the impact I was having.
Did you discuss your environmental concerns with the other people working on the project?
A little bit.
I mean, you make a really good point, because when you think about the number of NGOs that are working around the world to have impact, to help local communities or local environments, you don't really think about the broader ramifications or externalities of the fact that you're just describing the boats going back and forward, the plastic wrapping, the damage that's been done to the environment by bringing all these people from. When you talk about species coming into Cuba, or people, the populations bringing in, it's another example, almost like a ballast being released into the system and the impact. We don't think about it. We think we're doing good, but actually in the broader sense, you're right. Should it not be people in the local community being responsible? But it's a difficult one, because you could argue the positive benefit of having impact on some environmental or geological issue, that if people weren't coming in and affecting, now whether it be eggs or something else, there are certainly pros and cons. But I'd never thought about it the way when you're describing the sort of the boats going to the islands and importing and bringing in all this packaged food and packaging and plastic, and when we were conscious of all the plastic in the oceans and the environment, it does make you sort of pause and reflect.
I guess I've been quite like negative. Obviously, they do loads of great stuff as well. And even just like creating awareness on the locals on that island about, I was really surprised by how many Malaysians don't know how to swim. Mm. And they're an island nation. And teaching them about their own wildlife. Then it's also to some degree kind of a year-long tourism for those on the island that then to some degree rely on that NGO to have people there when it's a super kind of low season. Then maybe they also bring extra tourism. Then there is certain research that's interesting. If they do find a species that's extra protected, then that can kind of help maybe create an MPA zone around the island. So it's a really hard one to balance. And I think those that are doing it and invested are doing great things. Mm-hmm. But just on a personal level, I just saw more of the kind of my own negative impacts of me being there. And just I wanted my use of time and energy and resources to be applied in a different way.
All right. Escape from Malaysia.
So I escaped from Malaysia, was in London, kind of just working pub jobs, 6 months. And I'm kind of at a stage where, okay, I need something legit. But I didn't know, you know, in that, what was I, 22? So mm-hmm. you don't really know what you're doing. Yeah, 22, 23. And in terms of like, I'll sound like the biggest hypocrite now, but in terms of then wanting to do something impactful, I completely just like, paused that and left it and was like, okay, I need to make some money and I need to learn some kind of skills within the business or whatever else. So I joined Trail Finders mm-hmm. as a travel consultant just because I love traveling. So I thought, okay, I'll be able to travel for free pretty much. They had quite like a good reputation as a company. There was a lot of...
You're not good for your environmental impact. Your carbon footprint.
But then there was just... And then there was that element of me where I was like, and I've kind of like really been challenged by this a lot, but I was like, oh, maybe I can like infiltrate tourism into a better tourism, which is, I had a really funny example of someone that's starting up their own private jet company, but looking to get the kind of rich people that fly in private jets to offset their impact by, I don't know, subsidizing a new forest or whatever. And then you start to do the maths and you look at the reality and it's like, you're just, you know, greenwashing yourself to justify something that you know is kind of wrong, but you're trying to make it sound good or you have this belief. So I kind of had that. And if I'm putting a holiday together, I'm going to look at what's the sustainability rankings of this hotel, what kind of practices do they do? I'm going to, in my own way, now make things better by sending someone there rather than something else, which I think realistically didn't do much. But I learned a lot just in terms of sales, like use of softwares and like communication and people skills and logistics and like planning holidays that involve 50 different million elements. And then the pandemic hit. So if there was anyone...
It's going to get shut down very fast.
And what I learned a lot as well, I think one of the biggest things was, so the guy that runs it, Mike Gooley, he founded it in 1979, I think it was. And he just had these like really kind of core principles and values and practices, both to the staff and to the customers, just in terms of looking after staff, making sure that there's systems in place, onboarding, rewards, respect, everything else, but then also doing the same for customers. So I saw that, and what that meant was that when the pandemic did hit, they had everything kind of, they weren't now going to go bankrupt. They didn't go under. They stayed afloat. And actually, they weathered that storm when others like TUI and whoever the other student one was, did go into administration. They were then there to kind of actually come out of it stronger and better than before. But what I was going with that is that even all the kind of new recruits, we had this at the end of our training program, we would meet with Mike. You could tell at you, he was in his 70s or 80s, but he was still on the ground, involved in every decision. Yeah. And just quite like an inspirational figure within a business sense. Okay. Yeah. There's all the environmental things that are wrong with a travel company. But I think socially, at least how they went about their social practices with staff and customers, that was something that I really looked up to and thought, this is really good. And something that I've tried to kind of implement in my own ways with 99p films. But where I'm going with this is that, yeah, pandemic hit, obviously went on furlough, and the pandemic was difficult in all different ways, and I won't go into that. But what it meant in terms of the positive was that I actually had this time where I could finally say, okay, I can take a kind of creative path, which is paid for because I'm getting paid on my furlough, and I can now really explore that avenue. So it started off with photography, then kind of went into documentary filmmaking, and I was loving it. And
it's kind of still living in London.
Still living in London. Yeah. But London, like that the first few months, seeing that when all the planes stopped and the boats stopped and the cars stopped, whether it was just a really fortunate spring summer or whether it was directly linked to it, I can't remember the weather being as good as it was. Like, blue skies, the air was super clean. You'd go on a walk by the Thames, and at some points you could see the bottom. And it was like, I've never seen this before. And this is after 2 months. And that made me realize, like, just how incredible the wildlife around us is.
And how quickly an environment can change and heal. I know.
Yeah. It really does. And it gives a lot of hope, I think. In times now when everything seems a bit dire and negative, and both politics-wise and environment-wise, when you see something like that and it's, okay, this is actually really achievable. Okay, it's a feat and a massive task, but the result can be achieved in quite a short time span. So then when London went back to how it was, me as a person had kind of changed. I feel like London changed as well. Like, the spontaneity got sucked out of it. You had to book to have a pint, and you had to, and I was just, and I mean, I'm not a big drinker anyways, but just like the kind of nature of what London meant. I used to think it was the best city in the world. I now can't really, apart from seeing my mum and some friends, can't really stand it. I find it really just overwhelming and just not good for your brain. All the noise, the pollution, the constant busyness. So I kind of don't really enjoy going back. But it was that then, when Trailfinders called me back and said, okay, you ready to work again? I was like, here's my notice, packed up, moved to Cornwall.
And why did you pick Cornwall?
I mean, I love Cornwall. I used to always come for family holidays on my dad's side. So kind of English family, we'd go to a place around the corner called Port Scatho, pretty close to Falmouth. And just, it's just beautiful. Sea, cliffs, little Cornish lanes. So I have this nostalgic memory of just really nice experiences there. One of my uni field trips when I was at Southampton was actually to come to Falmouth. And we had a great 2 weeks here. And like, me and mates were like, oh my God, why didn't we do this in Falmouth kind of thing? And then the other thing was that the course that I wanted to do, which was a master's in film and TV, was here. And my partner at the time, she wanted to be a yoga teacher. And there was also a course in Falmouth for her. So it worked quite well.
Nice. So, yeah. All right. So that leads us to the big question is, what are you working to achieve an impact in this world with 99p films? And yeah, maybe contextualize how you ended up from going from the film and television masters.
Yeah, just a quick one to then bring it to 99p films. So everyone wants to be make their own production company or be a director, myself included. And as I was there, I started to realize, okay, there's loads of content, but how do audiences connect with that content, both in terms of where's it going and how are we perceiving it, how are we like ingesting it, if you want to call it that. But then that, through a lot of different bits and bobs, which I won't get into because I've realized, like, I've just been talking non-99p related stuff, finally led me to coming to this building, Launchpads, and setting up a business, which over time has finally formed as to what I see it now, which is essentially bringing people together through the power of social cinema. So social cinema is...
No, just before you get into defining what social cinema is,
yeah.
Why? What do you think it was in you that made you question and not go down the natural, the obvious path of going producer, director, screenwriter,
yeah, I guess
something?
A lot, yeah.
There must be something inside you that saw things differently, that your perspective on the world was that you paused and didn't, to actually sort of question that, because it's an unusual perspective to take, to think about things in that broader context.
The first was just looking at what were my peers and myself doing and what were the years before us doing. And if you'd create something, it would just sit on Vimeo or YouTube. Not really, that's not generating any money. You might pay to get into a film festival, and then your chances of that either being accepted, or even if it is accepted, then doing well. It was so super slim. And so it was like, okay, well, there's not a lot of prospects. If I'm now going to spend loads of time, it felt like it was kind of like flushing it down the toilet, because it's either just sitting there not being consumed, or you're paying for it to be seen by someone. So I kind of was just thinking the whole model here is flawed, and the current distribution model just needs a little bit of reinventing, or a new spark. And then
do you think the pandemic played a part in it?
Oh, 100%.
I suppose just because of when you're talking about it and content being streamed and distributed, when you think back to the classic days of cinema and storytelling. I mean, we've always been told stories around campfires or around the dinner table where people come together, or in theaters to watch plays. Mm-hmm. And yet we found ourselves in the pandemic, often isolated, whether it just be as a family, as an individual, or as a couple, consuming content endlessly, consuming content often together, but alone on these individual devices, that something feels alien to the natural way that we as humans consume content and tell stories together. And I'm just wondering if that as you went through this film and television course, there was something maybe subliminal bubbling up, the resulting 100%. From the pandemic.
I got into that kind of habit of, through the pandemic, you watch 10 episodes, it kind of auto plays the next one, and you're just kind of like brain dead and all foggy. Nothing's really had an impact, or if it has, you've then moved on to the next thing and you haven't given that time to ingest it. You're watching it on your own, which is a big thing. So then you can't really share how it made you feel, and you kind of left. I remember watching a super kind of, and we don't like to kind of normally show overly depressing films. We tend to kind of show things that have some kind of positive message. But I think it was Seaspiracy or one of those.
Oh yeah.
And I just felt horrible at the end of it. And it's, you kind of need that outlet to talk to someone, even if it's just to share how shit you're feeling, or to just, to have that social element. So there was that. Then there was also coming back to uni, I guess, as a mature student. And after the pandemic, it felt like all the kind of 18, 19 year olds didn't know how to talk to one another. And you wouldn't see groups together. You just go to the dining area, the stannery, and everyone's just on their own, just on their phone, eating on their own, watching on their own. So the pandemic and the effect it had on loneliness, isolation, all together, I really kind of wanted, that was a big impact on, how can we use something that people love watching stuff, and I don't think that's ever going to change, but I think how much we watch and maybe what we choose to watch can be tweaked. And you might have those days when you've had a tough week and you just want to binge something really rubbish on TV. That's fine. I have those. But at the same time, to do that every day and to do it on your own, I don't think it's good for us. We're social beings, and we want to have that element of kind of interaction and the more holistic approach where, in our case, the film only really makes, 30% of the night. So it's so many other bits. But I'm glad you kind of made that point, because that was actually a really big thing. And a lot of the kind of slides when I was putting together these pitch decks and presentations, my first slide would be just a bunch of images of people on their own watching TV and being this is a problem. And there was a number of problems, but that kind of isolation and just kind of ingesting and consuming loads and loads of content meaninglessly was one of them.
So social cinema, 99p films.
And to kind of, I think just another thing to point out, it wasn't instant. It wasn't just like, oh, this idea's come. It was lots of little kind of experiencing certain things that I took notes and tips from, a lot of which happened here. And I'm so glad that the Falmouth community, how interconnected it is, how focused it is on social and environmental issues, that helped a lot. So there was a lovely thing at this multi-faith chaplaincy on campus. A chaplain called Pete, who's a really good friend of mine. He's such a kind of became like a granddad figure from away from home, kind of granddads. And he did this thing called Movies and Meanings, which was just, it could even be a Disney film, but you watch a film and then you have a bit of pizza at the end and you just have a little chat. And that was just really nice. Initially went for the pizza, but then you come away and you're like, having a discussion is super nice at the end of it. Then I was kind of introduced to this thing called People's Assemblies. And it's a kind of, if we look at decentralization of power and politics, how can we give communities more autonomy in making their own decisions? And what does that look like? And how is it facilitated? And having these People's Assemblies where it's all about kind of circles, sharing points of view, getting into little like bubbles and kind of having discussions, that had a big role on how the discussion is facilitated. And I took loads of tips from the fact that you can have like a one-to-one discussion before you're discussing with the whole group, which allows like a more intimate, less intimidatory discussion. And then you open it up to like little techniques where if I'm hosting the night, you can just like raise your hands and you tell everyone else to raise their hands and it just silences a room. And it's all this kind of like non-violent communication and lots of these concepts. So that was all kind of flooding in. Then my partner was teaching me a lot of like breath work from the yoga that she was doing. And I was like, wow, this is really cool and it makes me feel great. What if this came before the film and changed your perception of it and allowed you to kind of clear those messy thoughts or overstimulated mind from the day before? And allow me to kind of fully engage with what I'm about to watch. So it was loads of these little things happening.
Almost like
happening.
A collection of serendipitous experiences.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Which is like music, right? No one's creating a new chord or a new tune. Everything's using past riffs and
yeah,
a blend of fusions and stuff to make something, I guess, kind of new. So I looked at all these great things that were happening either independently or not to the kind of like capacity or like smoothness that it could have been done. And then I tried to formulate that together into what I can now go on to talk about, which is this concept of social cinema. And I want to say that we like coined the term, but I have seen that term's been used.
You're inspired by Chaplain Pete, Movies and Meanings. You were influenced by witnessing and being part of People's Assemblies and then the breath work of your partner.
Yeah. So that's the breathe, watch, discuss elements. And then the feast or the kind of eat part, that was kind of where I got the main inspiration from. That was from a local CIC called the Falmouth Food Co-op, which I'm actually involved in. I'm on the board and involved in lots of different projects there, but they've got kind of different branches, one of which is a community field where you learn about growing. They've got a commercial plot and they would do these like really lovely like communal feasts in the summer. So like 100 people breaking bread around the table in this lovely allotment, eating some of the food that's grown there, and just a really nice thing to do. And made me think, oh, if you're trying to do a business or trying to do events, there's nothing normally that works better than like making sure there's some food involved. How can we incorporate that within the model? And I think it works really nicely, taking that conversation from the room, moving it to the dinner table, and then continuing it around food. And there's a lovely quote, I'm sure it came about beforehand, but the new Ken Loach film, The Old Oak, which is one that we screened last month, there's a phrase that says, when you eat together, you stick together. And that really connects with the whole notion of bringing our communities together, eating together. But then how do we do that in a sustainable way? So this is where like all the food that you're eating comes from local regenerative farms that are growing in these kind of sustainable practices. All the food's vegan, organic. So it's essentially, let's say you've just watched a film In Our Hands or Kiss the Ground about like soil health and farming. You're then at the end of that night eating part of the solution. And it's this idea that kind of we wanted for these events to have some kind of real impact. Not just, I think, like a legacy from after having gone to it, for it to maybe have changed you or created an awareness or wanted you to connect to something that you've watched. But for those that maybe don't have the time or the means or whatever to do that, they know that just by being there and eating that food, they are part of that solution. And we'll try to tweak it. So if it's like an ocean event, we'll have loads of seaweed on the menu. Or that's as kind of as much. Actually, no, we've done at the Old Oak, and we've done a few films around Gaza, Israel, the current genocide that's happening there now. And we had a Syrian refugee, which is a lovely lady called Iman, and she does the kind of the feasts and cooks these Syrian vegan feasts. So it's this notion of, we've just watched a film, let's say The Old Oak, for example, where refugees are essentially just dumped in like a northern town, and there's all the kind of issues that come with it, and then they kind of get over it and whatnot. And it's okay, well, we've had these refugees placed in Falmouth. We're now, as a company and loads of others, are getting people like her involved to be part of it and to be paid. Mm-hmm. And to be there on the night and to be respected and celebrated. So it's also kind of connecting foods to the evening.
Okay, so the concept, so 99p films, breathe, watch, what? Discuss, feast.
Discuss. Feast or eat? I'm still deliberating on, I like the word feast.
Feast is, I like it as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
sometimes it makes me think of a little bit of, like, overindulgence.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
You know, you can kind of like feast and like this whole capitalistic consumption. But then there's also like having a nice feast where you're actually just like sharing lots of different plates and there's a spread. So yeah, feast, eat, whatever. But that's our kind of signature formula.
Yeah. All right. Explain the concept of the 99p. And for people here in the US or outside or in Europe, 99 cents, maybe. Cents. Yeah. And it wouldn't be 99 cents. It wouldn't be 99 cents films. It'd be 99 cents cinema.
Perfect. Yeah. So where does 99p come from? That came initially from what the kind of original idea was, which was like an online platform to watch student films, and you pay 99p to watch that student film, and the 99p goes to the student filmmaker. And that's like changed and tweaked to what it is now. Is a kind of, I've got a little bit obsessed with the number 99, and I try to include it in loads of different ways. So I'll kind of go through some of the multi meanings that it has. The most simple one is that tickets start at 99p. So for the whole experience, breathe, watch, discuss with a meal, you can go for 99p. And that's set aside for, we call it the kind of 99p community ticket, which is for those in our community who are normally left out of these kind of events and these conversations. There's definitely a kind of, when you're looking at being maybe a bit of an eco-activist or a sustainability warrior, whatever you want to call it, it tends to kind of be your middle class, white, majority of the time, at least in Cornwall is the case. And at our events, we have a range of demographics, like colours, ages, genders. That was quite nice and just natural, and it just happened. But definitely still saw a sense of, it is the person that has the money to go to this that is going to come to it. So by kind of having that ticket, it removes the financial barrier for those that wouldn't normally go and allows them to be part of the experience, part of the conversation, and to just join in. Now, what I'm realizing is that that's not the only barrier. There's also time poor. A lot of people that are maybe in that position don't have 3 hours on a Sunday night or midweek to attend something like this. Maybe they've got to look after their kids. Maybe, you know, they haven't got money to pay for a nanny. Maybe they haven't got money to get there. Maybe they even feel out of place kind of going to a certain venue that has a certain kind of stigma, or there's a certain type of event that normally takes place there and they feel more comfortable somewhere else. So these are kind of things that we're trying to overcome and challenge, but at least financially, that's not, it's no longer a barrier. And the way that that works as a kind of the range of ticket prices is that then different people pay different amounts. So you have a concession ticket, which is a tenner, general ticket, which is 15. We do like student 2-for-1s. So you kind of bring a mate along. And that was a big part of kind of seeing all these students that were just on their own. Okay, we're not going to half the price for you, because then you'll just come on your own and pay half the price. If you come with a friend, then you kind of split, like you bring a friend for free. So trying to kind of gently encourage, you know, bring a buddy along kind of thing. And then there's also anyone under 18 comes for free. We have like a little thing on our website, and I think the first line is like, kids are the future. And I think that we really kind of have just neglected the youth, and they haven't got anything to do. And I was seeing this, especially, let's say in London, okay, you've got loads of stuff, but coming to Cornwall and seeing like 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, you're not quite that age where, okay, you can go to the beach and whatnot, but like actual activities, there's nothing for them. And I just saw where I was living before, like a bunch of teenagers are just smoking vapes behind like a public toilet and just like drinking loads of energy drinks and causing a bit of havoc and then getting a bad rep for it. Mm-hmm. They can all come, and they can come for free as long as they're with a guardian, because we've got to be by the law. We can't just have a load of unaccompanied minors, and there's certain things that I personally would say come along, but then there's like safeguarding and stuff that we have to be aware of and not be too ideological, and everything's gonna be fine. And yeah, but also for the parents that want to come to something like this, but they have 3 kids and they haven't got the money to have someone looking after them, bring them along. And I think having then that, like a really lovely thing about the evenings is this intergenerational discussion. So we've got the pensioner who's maybe chosen the concession ticket. We've got the 30 to 50 year olds are paying general or pay forward ticket. We've got the kids who are going for free. We've got the students that are having a half price. They're all getting the same experience. That there's no, you get a bigger portion of food or you get a smaller portion of food. I think there's no seat allocation. There's no nothing, like everyone gets the same. But by having those different ages and different perspectives that come with that age, or the kind of wisdom and the adolescence that come with it, unlocks different ways of viewing things.
Do you see this the impact of this intergenerational community in terms of the way the discussion? Because that must be the fascinating bit, is watching after the film. Because there's always going to be people that will be straight up with their hand with an opinion. But there must be a way where you start to see how different people come into the conversation and the discussion and how it evolves.
That's my favorite part. Yeah, that's my favorite part of the night. Like, just kind of afterwards sitting there and just watching this room just having like a buzz, and there's all these ideas and views. I mean, the kind of development of the conversation, that the way that we facilitate it is...
I was going to say, yeah, do you moderate it?
I'll talk you through what we do. So we always kind of start off by asking people to essentially look to the left or to the right, but to find someone that they didn't come with. So let's say you've come with your partner or you've come with your parents, to not talk with that person. Because one, you kind of know pretty much maybe where they're coming from on this matter, or maybe you're friends with them because they've got the same like thought process as you. But also you're going to go home afterwards, and if you really want to, you will have those discussions. But by asking people to sit next to someone different and have these like one-on-one conversations first, and when we like say, yeah, go talk, there's just this instant, like first you'll see a few people kind of looking around and being like, oh, I've never done this before. Yeah. Who am I going to talk to? And I'll kind of run between the audience. And if I see someone kind of just on their own, I'll just like kind of push them into a conversation. Uh-huh. Like, oh, talk to this person, like a little conversational matchmaker. But yeah, it's really beautiful to just watch. And then I'll kind of bring it back and do this technique where you just put your hand up and everyone else puts their hand up and it just creates silence without being like, attention, bring it back. And then the room opens up and there's always the first person takes a minute. But as soon as the first person's gone, then it's this bouncing off of ideas, different perspectives, and how we manage that. It's basically, I wouldn't say complete freedom of speech, because looking at it, if someone's going to be verbally abusive towards someone or be like aggressive, we wouldn't condone that. And luckily it hasn't happened. So I don't know, like, how we'd discipline it. Do we ask, is there a warning system? And then we just ask you to leave. If you're going to be like that, then you're not part of this conversation. But we always promote the kind of sense of it's okay to have different views. Like, no one is going to agree fully on anything. Like, we've all got our own, even if you all believe in God, what God looks like in your mind is different. So there's not like one thing, but just to be respectful.
Yeah, and
to
like, that's key.
We're giving you a chance to share your thing. Now give someone else a chance to share the complete opposite, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I think when looking at the impact of these events, I think I was initially very revolutionary in the sense that someone's going to watch a film about whatever it might be and leave and be converted, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. or like is going to, I'm not vegan. I do eat predominantly plant-based. But let's say we've shown a film about veganism, I'd maybe in my mind initially be like, and you're going to come out of it and have a vegan diet. Mm-hmm. And the more I've done it and the kind of just my own awareness, I think I'm valuing the fact that you don't need to kind of turn a yes to a no in that space, or turn a black into white, for example. It's more the fact that because you've had that awareness, both of the content that you've watched that has got educational elements to it, that has got eye-opening stuff, but also the different perspectives, even if you leave the exact same internal idea, I feel like subconsciously or even consciously, being in a room and seeing that 90% of the room disagree with you is going to have a certain impact and just make you aware of, huh, okay, I actually share this geographical region in Cornwall with others that don't agree like me, but we can still get along and we can still have a nice meal at the end of it, even if we've got completely contradictory opinions.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things there. I mean, it makes me think about a guest I had back in 2019 called Stephen Hecht. He's part of he's a Canadian and he runs the Young Presidents organization there. And he's written a book called Nonflict and created this methodology of conflict resolution in four simple steps. And he's brought together Israelis and Palestinians, obviously before the current conflict, and done it with Catholics and Protestants in Ireland, and had huge success with this methodology. And one of the key things is being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and understand where they're coming from. And that's the first key step. You ask people to listen, put yourself in my shoes, and you sort of tell the story. And I think thinking about that, and it's a really good book. It's a nice, easy, you should try and get hold of it. It's Nonflict by Stephen Hecht. But yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes. But also, as you were talking about these assemblies, John Alexander, I know we've talked about him before and what he's doing with Citizen, the book Citizens, and he talks about the power of people, citizen assemblies. And I think the great thing about, and the evidence is there, that even people like Rory Stewart, who was part of the Conservative government, has acknowledged that he would actually vote Labour this election if Labour actually embraced citizen assemblies, because he realises the power of them, that when people come together and they have a voice, people listen and they start to understand that we're actually all closer together in our belief systems than we are when we're apart and we're polarised by the media and the content we consume online alone, individually. But when we're in a group together, and we're talking, you start to see the nuances and the subtleties and the connective tissue between what people think and what they feel. And I think what you're talking about, it feels, it gives a forum for people to step inside someone else's shoes, even if they don't believe what they believe, but they can have empathy for them and be empathetic towards someone else's views. And maybe as you walk away being comfortable with the ambiguity of life.
Yeah. Yeah, just being aware of that difference. Mm-hmm. And being able to kind of like put a face and a voice to it. And it's not just, like you said, polarized or using religion or sexuality or whatever it might be to separate. And this whole divide and conquer, like it works. And I think it's being used within media and within the kind of, what do you want to call it, like the woke scene and everything else. And it's, let's just bring it back to, we're all people. I want you to be happy. I want to be happy. We're going to be different and we're going to naturally form our own little bubbles in the place that we do. But it's, we can get along and it's been proven that we can. And I like this kind of non-flipped way of doing it. There was talking about kind of Palestinians and Israelis. There was a TED talk I saw ages ago and someone used backgammon, the game backgammon, which I love. I mean, my best mates, we all, sesh it. But how to use games to not solve a conflict, but to kind of have a bit of a conflict within that game, and the game finishes and you're back to kind of real life and maybe you've raised your own war, but it's concluded and it was a game. And that then just makes me think about this nature of we should all be having a bit more fun and playing, and through play we learn, and through games and fun. That's when I had a team meeting the other day with five of us now at 99p Films, and we looked like what's the outcome, what do we want to do? And obviously there was bringing people together, creating awareness, supporting farmers and all of this stuff, but one of the main ones was, let's, like, whilst we're doing this, let's have fun. There's no point setting up a social cinema company and being depressed and miserable about it because of the work involved. It's, okay, we can be super creative, we can be social, we can have lots of fun doing it. So yeah, went a bit of a tangent there, but
no, it's great. It's a wonderful concept. It does lead to the question of how do you scale it, and do you want to scale it?
Yes, definitely. So yeah, in terms of scaling, I've tested the idea of how would this look outside of Falmouth, Cornwall. We've done a few in Truro, we've done some Bedroofen, and that probably means nothing, Ninuki. But is it the Cornish kind of communities that are really kind of wanting this, or is that demand seen elsewhere? And just from putting these events on, we always pretty much at any event will have someone being like coming to us at the end being like, oh, we'd love for you to do this where we are in Helston or in Totnes, or we have
Austin.
Austin, you know what I mean? So that already was kind of giving like me that validation that, okay, you know, that there's a demand. So then I needed a bit of a holiday because I'd just done like back-to-back master's programs and everything else. So in January, I went interrailing through Europe. And that's where I stayed with Gavin, who I met at this thing called Goodfest. And I think we'll chat a little bit about that at the end. But on this journey, I kind of did a few social cinema nights. So I did two in the Alps, did one in Zurich, went to lots of kind of cinemas in Berlin, and just kind of like looked at what are the Europeans doing. And what was really kind of reassuring is that I think especially in France and especially in Berlin, I saw was all this kind of like people coming together, lots of kind of communal farming and allotments, wanting to be educated on social and environmental issues and using talks and film and media to do it. And I was like, okay, this is not just an isolated feeling. It is global. So then came back and then have been exploring it within the UK and like Oxford, London, Brighton, Bristol. So it's got the grounds. So kind of, I feel like it definitely can work. And then comes like, how does that look? And what would essentially a franchise model be? And there's been a lot of deliberation and blah, blah, blah. But I think, and again, at this meeting, which was really beneficial, just having everyone there and we've got to a point now where we've done 23 events. Like, what's next? A bit of consolidation. And this, I had this idea for a handbook, like a manifesto, a Bible, whatever you want to call it, whether it's called the Pink Print, the 99p handbook, whatever. I use pink a lot because those are our brand colors, pink and purple. And it was just, yeah, being able to give it to someone for them to host their own night. But then one of the team, a girl called Minnie, and a few others have kind of like worried about the idea in terms of you kind of just giving your secret ingredient sauce away. So what it's looking like now is something that Minnie actually, like the term community consultants, which essentially how I've followed it from in my own mind is that we could kind of train people to become 99p hosts. I don't know, a one day training thing, whether it costs or whether we get like grant funding to subsidize it, because grants love to subsidize training, but to give people the skills to how to facilitate a discussion, how to maybe have some breathing workshop exercises, ingredient like cooking, but like the logistics, how do you go about the licensing? How do you go about this and that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, just thinking the regulations, knowing what the UK is like, and even just here in the US, you can't just suddenly say, we're going to get people to pay money to come in, whether it's 99 cents or $99, and you'll sit down and have a meal. How do you cook it? How do you ensure there's food safety there?
Yeah.
I mean, is it even just the logistics of that? Or there's a complexity
There's a lot. And there's the boring stuff like the food hygiene certificate.
Exactly.
And then there's the fun stuff, both which are relevant. So that would all kind of be within this handbook and within kind of this training, for example. And then the way I see it is then you've got 100 hosts that then can take that model with a bit of kind of support to do it in their own places. But for it to, I wouldn't say to have complete free roam with how that looks. I think they can choose the location, they can choose the theme, they can choose. There's a bit of issues with like, what if we get some kind of ultra far right Nazi youth group that wants to.
No, but it's the same as I talked about when we first spoke, Matt Potts with Camarados and his public living rooms. They've got a simple 6 steps to running a public living room that you have to adhere to. And people follow it. And it's not a set of rules. It's a guideline. And each one could look a little bit different in terms of the furniture. But the principles through which people adopt stop it from being a far-right neo-Nazi public living room you know, whatever. So I think it's definitely the route you should go with it.
Yeah. So that, and I've already got some of those principles in mind, kind of setting aside a certain percentage of tickets, 99p, so that there's always that blend. Mm. Then the other 99p element is that I really want to kind of create that as a licensing model. So when we work with independent films, 99p from every ticket sold goes to the filmmaker.
Oh, nice. All right. Okay.
Which is nice because, let's say, on average, a concession is £10. It's about 10%. But if you have 150 people there, the filmmaker gets 150 quid, which is way better than a lot of these independent filmmakers who have their stuff on Vimeo and YouTube that you can watch for free. It's been a little bit trickier working with kind of high production companies and like distributors that have their fixed rates. So there'll be a bit of work around that. But a lot of the time...
Couldn't you do an alliance with Water Bear?
Already kind of have, and the alliance there is that we can show their content for free as long as the event is free. So we've done that before, and I would love to imagine you can then select any Water Bear film, maybe the event is free, and then you just kind of charge for the food, for example, or I don't know. But there's loads of different things that kind of can come, and lots of ideas, but essentially some kind of principle manifesto that then keeps a certain standard but still gives each host the kind of free reign to make it their own. And then like how do we make money from that? Well, the way I see it is that apart from the license fee, the host should get everything because they're the ones that then has to pay for the chef or the food or the venue hire. They're the kind of event organizer. And we would just have a thing where it goes through our website. So like Eventbrite, where you want to put on an event, you use Eventbrite. Either we just have compulsory commission, or we just have kind of like how Crowdfunder has it, where you can donate to us. So at the end, when you've paid for your ticket, you can make a donation to 99p Films, whether it's a suggested 99p donation, or if you really love what we're doing and you want to give 100 quid, whatever it might be. But I just kind of see it as that, and giving, we give our audiences and the people that we work with a lot of trust, you know.
Yeah.
I guess everyone could buy a 99p ticket, and if so, we'd probably go bust, but they don't. And it's quite like a nice like breath of fresh air to say,
yeah, okay. If you set it up and say that 25% of the tickets are 99p, or I mean, if you say you limit it to people under that have to be students, there are probably ways and mechanisms you can sort of set limits in terms of who can buy the 99p.
Yeah. We could do. But the other thing I was going to say, and I think this is actually one of your questions, was about would we take it to Zoom?
Yeah.
And I've given that a lot of thought, because the kind of my like conundrum with it is, on one side, I want to adamantly say no, and that this is, in the very nature of it, a social experience. Okay, we're socializing now, for example, to some degree, but like I feel like there's something beautiful in the fact that it's in person, and the fact that you're seeing that person in the flesh, you're shaking their hand when you talk to them, you're eating with them, you're breathing, the breathing and the fact that you can hear everyone else breathing, that you're part of it. And that can't be replicated to the same degree
that's
online.
Mm-hmm.
And this very fact that if it was online, then maybe so many of those people that would go in person just going to watch it from home. And then just going back to this,
it's
very problem.
I see the point, yeah.
The only thing that tells me to do it online is when you're looking at like inclusion and make like accessibility.
To your point, if someone can't make it because of the kids or the distance,
why should they then be ruled out because it has to be in person? Or even, let's say, kind of disability wise, if you're bedbound and you can't make it to the event, then you're taking that event away from them. So whether it's that there's that sways us to have that option open for those that want it, or how I see it is that we'll be doing so many, it will get such a reach that the person that can't come to that one can actually go to the one next door, or maybe you have it within like a home and you invite some neighbors and you kind of still have that social element, but from the comforts of your own space. So that's I'm still not decided on that. But for now, it's just in person.
What about brand partnerships? I mean, a lot of brands talk about purpose and having social impact and their CSR values and all that. They're always looking for interesting ways to overcome maybe negative perceptions towards the brand or make people more positively align with it. I mean, obviously there's an amazing brands that do great things. And where you were showing, let's say, an environmental film, Patagonia could be an amazing supporter. There must be plenty of environmentally friendly, environmentally positive brands, local brands in Cornwall or just even in the UK. That must open up huge commercial opportunities for what you're doing.
It does. And I think that's, if we're going to look at sustainability as a business, like how do we create the revenue to continue, those partnerships are going to be a big like cash boost, because these community events are lovely and great and do so much, but they kind of pay for themselves just about. So it's that the money is not coming from them for us to really grow. And when it comes to partnerships and collaborations, we've already done loads. We're in terms of some of the big ones. So the next event is going to be with Falmouth Marine Conservation Group. We're going to be doing another one in May with Natural England. Some of the ones we've done in the past, we've worked with Pride, so Cornwall Pride, And that's where we did a selection of queer shorts in Truro Cathedral, which is a really progressive step forwards. We've worked with like other kind of Cornish film groups like Screen Cornwall, Sea Film, More Meat. But yeah, partnerships also with the foods that we're getting. And for this one in with Natural England, we'll be hopefully getting loads of Cornish seaweed from the Cornish Seaweed Company, or we'll get partnerships with different local farmers and food suppliers. So we want to do like a mushroom event and mushroom film, and we'll work with this lovely lady called Faye that runs A Taste of the Good Life, and she grows her own mushrooms. But then there's also the bigger, more like commercial partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have asked me like, oh, what do you do if BP, for example, come to you and say something like that? And I don't know what I think a good example, which someone recently asked me, is like Cornish Lithium. So it's, okay, that's a mining company. But then again, I've just spent all weekends doing up an electric bike that has a lithium battery.
Yeah.
So I need these items. Okay, I need it. Do I need it? I sold my car and I'm using this in return. I'll be charging it with green powered electric. So there's a whole conundrum in that. But bring it back to, let's say, like Cornish Lithium. Can, if we are going to be mining and we need resources, we need minerals, the way I see it is that the current case is that you've got slavery and exploitation of people in the Congo and other like African countries where they're treated like shit. Then the land is completely destroyed and just abandoned, and then you have your resource. Or alternatively, could we have someone like Cornish Lithium that is relatively new in this area, is kind of getting quite a lot of investments, and maybe has reached out to us wanting to have that kind of like customer feedback on, or watch a film about it, and say, okay, do we just give up on these corporations that are doing things wrong, Southwest Water or fossil fuel companies? Or do we say, okay, we're actually going to share with you and push you in the right direction? Now, maybe that's me being that travel agent that thought I could encourage eco-tourism, but I actually think that there is something to it.
And it's better to be having a narrative and a dialogue with these organizations. And if it's a conduit to having that positive dialogue, and even marginal influence is better than nothing.
Yeah.
So,
and if they're then giving us a load of money that we're then injecting into loads of other community screenings, mm-hmm. like I just, especially the mining one, because there's a lovely quarry community called Trevone Quarry, which in terms of future 99p vision, we're currently making a documentary about it. So we also want to create our own content. And their example is that they kind of bought this quarry that was disused, abandoned. It was an old granite quarry. They've converted all the old quarry buildings into studios and workshops and living spaces. And they've brought the area back to life and kind of revitalized the nature and created a nature reserve. And you just think, okay, actually, if we did mining properly, we could take an area of lands that was a brownfield site. You still be selective on where you're going to mine. There's a lot of lithium or more. Pay people a good wage, create employment, support the local community that has mining in its blood, and a lot of people are looking for jobs. And then have a long-term vision of what that area can look like, where you've extracted this resource, but you've also converted a brownfield site into a nature reserve. And it's, you've ticked loads of boxes, and then that completely flips the kind of view on mining as this horrible, destructive, exploitative practice into, oh, it's actually creating jobs, regenerating the lands, and it's giving us like loads of batteries that we can have a shift in. I mean, that's a discussion itself. Are electric cars better, worse? But you know what I'm saying? I'm kind of looking at it in that way.
One thing I'm going to say, though, I just finished South by Southwest, which is a big film, music, and interactive tech festival here in Austin. Amazing. Goes on for a couple of weeks. I am planning to actually apply to do a panel next year. I think it would be great to do a panel on 99p films and to use it as a way to then allow you to bring and do a 99p film event here in Austin next year.
I love the sound of that.
Because it would be an intersection between interactive social cinema and the film festival itself. Mm-hmm. And you've got great locations here for all the films and great food community as well. So we should follow up and talk about doing a panel and an event.
We'll train you as a 99p host.
No, you could do that while you're here. But yeah, but it would get you on stage and get the story.
Yeah. But see, this is it. Obviously, that sounds very appealing for me. Mm-hmm. Traveling and like going to different places and stuff. And then it makes me think about my own carbon impacts.
Yeah. But I think that's where it comes down to this, going back to the conversation around Malaysia. Yeah, there's a negative externality, but what's the broader positive benefit? I mean, if you could, through just an example, being able to get your story out to people at a place like Southwest, what would the connections result in? Of people going, okay, this is value, and you suddenly start to find your franchise model could scale faster. Anyway, something to talk about after this.
Yeah. But I think it is important, just quickly though, it's that justification. How far do you take that? And the billionaires that are flying around on their super yacht, like super jets, or the top hundreds polluting companies, are they sat there being like, oh, people need to have their mobile phone, or like we're, I don't know, making cutlery and people have to use cutlery, or that very nature of, is a really good example. If someone doesn't sell heroin outside of a school, if I'm not doing it, someone else would do it. That's a little bit extreme. And all you're asking me to do is come to Austin. I'm very humbled and thank you for the offer. I don't want to shun that, but I think, and it can be quite dangerous. This mentality is that you then overthink absolutely everything, and life becomes a bit miserable because it's, oh my God, whatever I'm doing, there's a harm to it. And you can kind of fall down a path where there was this one guy that he wanted to only use electric cycling because he realized that if he was using a manual bike, he'd need to be eating more to create that energy to use his legs. You go down this like field where it's just, you can't live. So that there's, I don't want to go down that path, but I'm also kind of, I want to be very aware and careful on like my point of view and how I practice my own life. If I'm going to preach all these things through 99p films, I kind of want to live it as well, which I do. But we'll talk about this Austin because that sounds cool. Okay. And we'd love to know more about it.
All right. Last question on 99p films and social cinema. Where would you like to see it over the next 5 to 10 years?
Next 5 to 10 years, just loads of 99p events happening simultaneously, talking about social, environmental issues, communities coming together and forming new relationships and a bit of autonomy, and the fact that maybe some of those conversations and connections began at a 99p event. The fact that we'll be hopefully making our own documentaries. So kind of like Netflix started off as purely streaming other people's, and now you've got Netflix Originals. Would love to also be part of the kind of production of content. And I've learned so much by screening all these films and by hearing the discussions. As a potential or kind of part-time filmmaker myself, it's given me the awareness of what like works and what doesn't, and what kind of like how to tell stories. And so I would love for us to be producing our own content. And then like on a personal level, like within the team, to just do really epic events and do them at the Eden Project, or do them in just locations that can have bigger capacities, or outside, or in a quarry, or out on the sea, and having a floating projector.
Who or what inspires you?
Who or what inspires me? Oh, that's a big one. I don't want to kind of use this as a way to avoid the question, but I've never really been someone that has had like an idol figure or a musician that I've worshipped or an artist or even like a filmmaker.
But that's why the question's who or what.
But then I still want to keep it onto the who, because I get like little inspirations from lots of people in different ways. I might be inspired by my mum because of the fact that she was a single parent. She came from Serbia to London. She did everything and raised me. Like, that's an inspirational figure for those elements. Or even my brother, like, he's 16 and he's so wise and his like way of looking at things. Or some of the team, like Jack, Meg, they're like creative views, and or like the people that I'm living with at this quarry and their perspective of life. So it's I don't like to take complete whole from just one person. I like to take it little golden gems from each. And I think I look at religion in the same way. Like, I don't align myself with one religion, but I'm super spiritual. And I take a lot from Christianity, a lot from Islam, a lot from Buddhism, but I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a Muslim. And in that way, I don't kind of have one figure, but I take inspiration from lots of different things in different ways.
Good answer. You've gone through a really interesting journey. And it's actually, before I ask the question, just an observation that when we started talking, you talked about this sense, if you've got of be your worldview, if you describe yourself as a social butterfly. In a way, it feels you've landed in your natural environment with what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You talk about taking inspiration from all these different people, the little bits of it, and you are this, almost like this, not just social butterfly, but your social connector, that you're feeding a community. And the way even what you said, you just see yourself as a mirror. I think that mirror is also you're allowing people to sort of reflect on issues and questions that they wouldn't otherwise do without 99p films and social cinema. So I think there's a really interesting sort of coming together of who you are as a human being and what you're actually doing now is meeting it's a natural meeting point. Anyway, that's just observation. But you have gone through this interesting journey, and you've obviously had to encounter lots of uncertainty, and we all encounter fear, uncertainty and doubts as we go along. How do you deal with it?
Yeah. Firstly, I would like, that was a nice psychological analysis, and I would definitely agree that I finally, you know, whether 99p lasts or doesn't, it fits all the ideas and my own like personality and everything else. So I feel really blessed that like I'm in this position and I've got kind of not the freedom, but yeah, the ability to play with it and see where it goes. And hopefully it does go into that 5-10 year vision. What are the hurdles, the barriers? I mean, I'm a very positive person, like optimistic person. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I really believe in this whole, you know, like the kind of positive energy that if you're going into something with a certain kind of mindset, this ability to manifest it. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm also maybe a little bit stubborn, or I can not be confrontational, but I'll speak my mind. And if I disagree with something, I'll say it, and I won't be shy to do that. And I think there's probably a definite amount of privilege that has given me that sense of security to do that. I'm a white man, I'm tall. These like social constructs that have partly played in that kind of makes me feel that I can do something, that I believe in it, but also the nurture from my mum's side that has always like believed in me, and lots of my friends and other people around me that are quite supportive. So I think, yeah, like barriers, challenges come and everything else. And especially like putting an event on, there's always something. And I've kind of like got to the point now, like a recent like way of processing and thinking about things is that and this isn't my words, I can't remember where I heard this, but it's not like the event that happens around you is how you personally deal with it. So shit can hit the fan, you can either scream and run around and blah, 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 or you can be like, okay, that's happened, recognize it. How do you deal with it? How do you get through it? And then not how do you forget about it, but that's past now. Let's like move on and learn from those lessons or learn from that experience, but to not let it like consume you and now change everything going forwards, because you can't change the past, but you can learn from it and change the future. So I can't really exactly remember the question, but in terms of like barriers, challenges.
No, just your fears, uncertainties.
There's a little bit of like overwhelmingness. There's a lot. And a lot is like resting on my shoulders. And I was like spinning a lot of different plates. And I just, yeah, definitely like found it a little bit overwhelming. But I've also learned to delegate and to, like, in the kind of right way, like either remove myself from something or find someone else to kind of follow those different channels so that I can kind of release the burden. And I think I was becoming a bit like, I was like living 99p films, and I still kind of am, but I was maybe living it to a slightly unhealthy level where that's all I wanted to talk about. And it consumed me, and it was at that stage where it was a baby and it did need my time. And maybe that's just the nature of it, that at that point it did just need my full attention, like a month old baby. That baby's now grown up a little bit. And also I saw the effects on myself, which is why I took this interrail trip where I just spent a lot of time. I mean, being in the Alps was beautiful, and spending time with Gavin, but also being in this Christian commune that just like made me kind of like just take a minute to get away from this wheel that I was trying to like develop this business and be like, you know what, if you haven't got the kind of physical and mental health to do that, you're not going to be able to continue. So kind of like taking it back a notch and giving myself those days of spending time with friends or playing music or going to the beach or whatever it might be. Because if you're not physically active, at least for my body especially, I find that if I'm not physically active, then like mentally my rate goes down. But if I'm not in a good space, then I'm not going to be productive. So I'd say, yeah, that was like the overwhelmingness, and like, how do you go about everything and all the different elements? And I just kind of partly rode that storm and got through it, and partly delegated and partly worked on myself. And I am feeling in a better position now to continue.
Okay. Now you've got a little bit of time and space for yourself. Is there any book that you'd recommend people should read?
I'll just say the one that I'm reading now because I'm enjoying it. It's called Chasing the Scream. The author is Johan Hari, but it talks about our like addiction and kind
of. Yeah, I know. I know. I met him. I met him at an event in New York. He spoke. Yeah. One of his previous books before that one. So I know who you mean. Yeah.
So a friend of mine visited recently and gave me two of his books, Chasing the Scream, and I'm guessing the other one that you're probably thinking of.
Yeah.
But yeah, just, I'm just enjoying it. Maybe more so just the writing style. I'm very fussy with writing style, and I like something that I can kind of read in the same way that I think. But I'm only a few chapters in. But from what my friend said, just like that the way we view addiction, reliance on drugs,
and recovery,
the war on drugs, recovery, how to take a different approach. I think we really need to like, going forwards with governments and policies, I think we need to be bold and not daring, but to like really test ourselves and say, you know what, I'm going to put myself on the line, and I'm going to try something a little bit radical. Look at Portugal, and actually it really worked. So even from councillors to prime ministers, presidents, I think there's a real issue with like people kind of not wanting to break out of the current norm, because they're scared that they're going to be the person that legalizes weed in the UK, and then you're going to have I don't know, like a high epidemic or whatever it might be. But actually having the kind of courage to say, you know what, this is not like a rash decision.
Try walking around the streets of New York now.
What's it like?
You can smell it. Yeah, everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, so that's just an example, but you know, for whatever it is, or just, I think just putting yourself out there and saying, I'm going to make a decision. I'm going to stick with it. If it fails, it fails, but not just kind of being timid and just, oh, let's just continue as usual, because nothing's going to change.
Okay. You obviously, with Social Cinema and 99p Films, screen a lot of films. Is there any film someone should watch that they might not have encountered?
I would definitely suggest the film Gaza, which was released, I think, 20... I'm going to check because I want to make sure. 2019, is it? Yeah, 2019. Okay. So this is before October the 7th. But the reason why I suggest this is because it gives you the perspective of the people living in Gaza, the fishermen, the tailor, the farmer, the voices that we don't hear. The only time we hear their perspective, unfortunately, is when they're screaming and crying because they've either lost their family or they're in the rubble themselves. And that's the only association we have with Gaza. They're not a human that has a job, that goes fishing, that has fun with their friends and has a party and whatnot. They are just that one emotion.
Where can people find it?
It's on everything. It's on
Netflix.
Amazon Prime.
Okay.
It's on Amazon Prime. That's the best place
to
watch it. There's a few others. A short documentary called Kelp, all about seaweeds. A really cool Dutch documentary called Paved Paradise, looking at biodiversity loss. A film called My So-Called Selfish Life, looking at like reproductive justice and like the woman's choice not to have a kid. So yeah, we've shown some really cool stuff. Like Ken Loach's new film is a really nice one as well.
Let's go on my list.
Yeah.
That's good.
Okay. Lots of cool films and we're going to show hopefully hundreds, thousands more.
Exciting. Is there any life hack that you would share? Anything that's made your life easier?
I mean, there's like the basics of try to eat good food. I think diet just has such an impact. We kind of forget, both on physical health and mental health. A film we showed recently called What the Health talks about the fact that doctors just, they have about, at least in America, they've got 4 hours of nutrition training. No, I think it's seven hours of nutrients training every 4 years.
I know, it's crazy.
Eat, you know, what you put in your body, that's massive. Mm-hmm. Exercise, whether it's a walk, whether it's just like walking under a building that has scaffolding and just do a pull-up, even one pull-up, and you'll feel like a boost of adrenaline. So I think, yeah, moving your body, being out in nature. I guess I'm on the bandwagon of the whole cold water therapy, but it's amazing. I still chicken every time I'm about to get into the sea. And I'm like, and you do it and you come out and you feel like a superhuman. You've got this... What's it meant to be? It's apparently like taking cocaine, but it lasts for 8 hours.
Wow.
I've never taken cocaine, so I don't know. But so just these kind of things and just like appreciating like, well, it's hard though. Some of these things definitely come with the fact that I'm in Cornwall and I can do that, or I have the money to buy the food. So, you know, what can I suggest?
No, I think they're good.
I guess
that's good. We'll leave it
there. You know what though? Just one last thing that everyone you'd hope can do is like maybe around 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock, just don't look at your phone and just like disconnect from your phone, your laptop, read a book before bed, fall asleep. You'll have better dreams. You have a better sleep. And I mean, I've been like tempering with that for ages and only the last 5 days now I've stuck with it. Mm. And I do, feel nicer for it. And I'm not so glued to my device. Mm-hmm. So maybe I think that's something that everyone can do.
Yeah.
Put your phone down is my advice. Life hack.
All right. A question we also ask at the end is, are you open to us connecting you with others through a process of random engineered collisions with other ex-guests. And I think from our previous conversation, you are with people like John Alexander and Math Potts, and maybe even Edward Malkinbar. I think we have some good conversations resulting from that.
Yeah, I would love that.
So we'll do that.
And I guess it's a nice time to give a thanks to Gavin from
Gavin Fernie-Jones, who recommended you. Yeah, as who we interview next.
Yeah. Yeah. Met him at Goodfest. We were just walking there, sunrise morning, started chatting. And then after the weekends, yeah, got along, got close, ended up going to the Alps and spending time with him. And I think what he's doing, looking at keeping clothing in the loop, is amazing. And hopefully going to collaborate with him by creating 99p merchandise.
Yeah.
You know, even on that element, it's like, okay, are we going to get someone to grow a new cotton plant, then use shitty dyes? And
no, you're not. It's going to be all recycled or repurposed. So it's a perfect partnership.
Yeah. So really happy that he suggested me to speak to you, because I've really enjoyed this, and I'm sure that it's going to it's going to create some random collisions. So yeah.
So that's good. Okay. And then the final question then for you is, who do we interview next?
I've got two people. But one is, he's actually outside. That's mad. That is so crazy. He just arrived and just outside and just went. I'll start with Jack. So Jack's involved in 99p films. We studied together doing marine biology, and he kind of took his own creative path and went down the more illustration art side of it. And he's really just focused on, How do we use art to communicate and to create awareness in a kind of visually appealing way? But also, he's very psychological and looks at other things. So I kind of chatted to him about it. I think that's where he'd like to go. And he's obviously involved in 99p films. So I don't know if that was my kind of conundrum, is that, you know, am I just giving you someone else that's also going to just talk about 99p films? And he's a freelancer as well, so would suggest Jack. But if you wanted someone kind of outside of our team, my mate Stephen Davies, I think it is. I don't know a lot of people's surnames, but he runs with his partner a group called Social Designs. So they're a community interest company architectural firm, and kind of part of like a bigger thing called Recollective. So I always get Recollective and Gavin's Reaction mixed up.
Reaction, yeah.
But what they're all about is kind of similarly to what Gavin's doing, but more focused on building materials, is how can we like reuse materials that, for instance, a big part of what they do is film and TV production studios that will put up, let's say like Amazon Prime, will create massive, I don't know, production design, wooden castle elements that they'll use for Game of Thrones. They'll film it, and then at the end of it, it'll go into waste. And it's like, okay, well, how can we actually both take that resource away from them, which can, they'll pay for that because they're paying for it to go into waste, and then redistributing it to a community that wants to build a community building or a space that, I mean, I think I mentioned Loveland, this community allotment, they're going to build this kind of community building there from some of these types of resources and materials. And it's, keeping this kind of stuff in the loop alongside. I've really learned a lot from him, like the power of architecture, the power of spaces and what that does to us. And like, how do we connect with spaces? What does being in a certain space and the materials used or the size or the proximity, like how that affects us on a mental level, but also like how we feel, like going to a church, you get certain feeling, the same with any kind of religious building or being like a little wooden shack in the forest. So he's a really interesting guy. I think lots of kind of maybe similar things with what a lot of people that you like to interview, like this kind of circular economy.
Sounds fascinating.
So yeah, I mean, they're both great, but I think if you wanted someone like maybe outside of our own.
No, I think that's good. I think it's good to sort of to make the next connection, because it would, I think it,
yeah,
with some, if with Jack sounds interesting, but I think it would naturally then come back to 99p films and go over the same sort of area of conversation. So,
and then Jack recommends the next 99p team, and then we just overtake your podcast.
Yeah, only if you come to Austin.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, thank you very much, Alex. It's been fascinating, and just hearing about your journey and the amazing work you're doing, the impact you're having on people's lives, albeit in a sort of a microcosm of Cornwall. But it sounds like as it scales, it's there's a genuine need. And we didn't even touch on AI, and as artificial intelligence scales, and it will require us to rediscover who we are as humans. It feels to me that what you're doing is creating experiences and moments and places, spaces where people can come together to rediscover who we are as human beings through breathing, through watching, through discussing, and obviously through eating or feasting, whatever you end up calling it. So I think it's lovely.
Yeah.
And I think all power to you to do more. So yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, that's all for now, folks. Now here's my ask of you. Please follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever player you use. Also, please subscribe to our new Random Collisions newsletter. We really are working to build a global community of action takers, action engines of people that really care about the problems that need solving. Thank you very much, and see you next time.